Hello everyone and welcome to episode 61 of Dominaria's Judgment, a weekly Constructed Magic podcast brought to you by me, Dom Harvey, along with Ari Lax. Today, we are getting into, I guess, eternal questions of magic is how to win my bad matchups. And usually this is a question I like to dodge by just not having those in the first place. And there was a time where the amulet aficionados would proudly boast that they had hashtag no bad matchups. Don't think that was ever true. And I think in magic these days, there really is no one in any format that can actually sincerely claim they have no bad matchups. So this is going to be an issue regardless of who you are and what you're playing. And I think having a big picture understanding of how to fix that is important. And then also we're going to use some specific case studies to kind of give some word examples there too.
Yeah. And even if you think your deck has no bad matchups, you probably have some that are tough where you have to really deviate what you're doing in order to get from like 45% to 55-60%. And I think that those are also matchups that fall into the same category of like, I am struggling and I don't really know what I need to do to fix it. And that's like the same kind of strategy you can apply to those.
Yeah, it can be tough to realize your equity in a given matchup. And there are some, and I think these are the most interesting cases, honestly, where depending on the specific card choices involved and who the players are, you can see that matchup being, you know, 45-55 one way versus the other way. And knowing how to flip that 5% in your favor can end up making all the difference. But first, we have the results from the weekend to get to, and also some brief housekeeping. So, as always, you can find the podcast on Twitter at Dominaria_pod. You can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/Dominaria_judgment. And you can find us and an increasing mass of people over in the Discord. So regardless of whether you're a patron or not, work your way in there and join that conversation. And someone who did become a patron this week is a friend of the show, the one and only Doomrake, Devin O'Donnell, who you can find streaming mostly Rhinos, but also a wide array of other things basically every day, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, mostly it's Pioneer and then also Rhinos is my understanding.
There's some occasional reliving of glory days with, you know, if an Asmo deck top-8ed some tournament in the past week, then you can probably pencil that one in there. But yeah, a great variety streamer may be the wrong word, but a great streamer that you should check out if you're interested in Constructed Magic in any capacity.
Absolutely. With that, do you want to start talking about some modern results from this weekend? There is a relatively small number of tournaments, unless you have... Well, you probably know where St. John's is, because I don't know where it is. But there was a modern event held by Face to Face there, and I have no idea what won.
I don't really know where it is. I'm told it exists, and I'm willing to believe that, but it may be the kind of thing where some colonial explorer discovered it in, like, 1657 and laid claim to it, and you know, no one has heard anything from it since then. So that's basically the status it has in my mind at the moment. I'm told there was a face-to-face tour stop there this past weekend, and if and when we find actors from that, I guess we can follow up on that next week. There was also, I want to say, somewhere in France, Grand Biche, I believe, there was a pretty large paper modern tournament, around 200 players, where first and third place were both Calibrated Blast. So, could not tell you anything else about that tournament, but I feel like that itself tells you all you need to know.
That is eventful. That feels like something from like a month ago, just stepping out into the blast zone, because that deck has one very, very bad matchup among the top decks in Modern, and that deck had a really darn good weekend on Magic Online.
Yeah, I always wrote off the Calibrated Blast deck as the kind of thing which you mess around in a league with, or maybe in a challenge if you're blowing off steam and your mana traders or your cardholder subscription lets you get access to all of this. But the actual process of building this in paper and tracking down all of those you know, deserts and Shadow of Mortalities and all of the various copies of both Besaidus that you need in your 75, you really have to be committed to the bit to do that, but it sounds like at least two people in this tournament were, and they were handsomely rewarded for that.
Yeah, well, on Magic Online, results tell a little bit of a different story. The Saturday Challenge was won by Grixis Shadow, a deck that's a pretty bad matchup for Calibrated Blast. Not horrific, because Drowning the Lock doesn't really do as much as you'd expect it to, but just a lot of the raw aggression there, like discard spells, are all problems. Defeating in the finals, the Grixis Shadow player, Spicy Leche, took down Crusher Bot BG with classic Crusher Bot Hammer. Notably, I think that the deviation, like, everyone played Lurrus before and then Crusher Bot didn't. Now everyone is playing Cauldre Complete except for Crusher Bot, which is really funny because it's like one of the cards you would play, like you would drop Lurrus for. And now that you're allowed to play it, everyone else is playing it. Crusher Bot's just like, no, 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 we're good with an Edelcyst and a Sword of Fire and Ice, and that's the equipment suite.
Yeah, this is a Crusher Bot list that you would not have been surprised to see 6 months ago or more at this point. And back in the day, if we can say that, when Crusher Bot was top 8ing or winning, it seemed like every single modern challenge, then you really got used to some of those signature cards. So the Mana Ties in the sideboard, always good to see those back in there. The Mortarpod, the copies of On Thin Ice. The thing that really stands out to me about this list in particular is 4 copies of Drynath Magistrate in the sideboard, and I think in part that's a response to the Rhino's resurgence that we've seen in recent weeks, where if you just want cards against the Cascade decks broadly, then your Magistrate does that, and a few other cards do that. You could play your own Chalice of the Void, for example. But the thing that Magistrate does in particular is it is much more, or much less fragile, excuse me, against cards like Fire Ice, Bonecrusher Giant, Prismari Command. Like, a 1-3 is surprisingly hard for Rhinos to actually kill unless they have, like, exactly Fury and the right stuff to follow it up with.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a classic case of, like, they want to kill all of your other cards in a specific way, so you want your hate card to not die to those things. Like, people make this mistake a lot. I think the classic example was, like, Affinity boarding in a bunch of like Relics or Tormod scripts to beat Dredge, when really the best answer most of the time was like some creature or Leyline of the Void, so it couldn't just be Ancient Grudge.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect comparison. And when I pulled up these lists to start diving into these results, you said that Crusher Bot made it to the finals, you lost a shadow in the Saturday Challenge, and I had the results open and I was thinking, wait, hold on, do you have your wires crossed here for a second? I am seeing Crusher Bot won this event. Turns out I just had the Sunday Challenge open, which Crusher Bot won to follow up that second place from the day before and really put a nice caps in on the weekend.
Yeah, Crusher Bot had a hell of a weekend. Same list both days, no changes, just doing the thing. Just winning games with the Paradise Mantle and Cranial Plating. And also the hammer stuff.
Yeah, I'd like to think that he and Happy Sandwich have some kind of friendly rivalry going on, and having seen Happy Sandwich dominating every tournament in sight with their build of Azorius Hammer, Crusher Bot just decided to put a few more results up on the board, just to remind people who's boss.
Yeah, you know, if you look at Crusher Bot's Magic Online history, there's like always a couple weeks of lull, and then just like, oh yeah, weeks where it's like, oh yeah, back-to-back top 8, win top 8. And a couple weeks off, and then, oh yeah, 1-2 in a row, you know, that kind of thing. So, yeah, pretty good results, and the good Hammer players continue winning with Hammer. Though, we do see a previous Hammer player showing up in this top 8 further down, picking up Shadow in Dymax. I believe that they were on Hammer for a decently long time earlier this year.
Yeah, I think they are someone who does like to jump around to whatever they perceive the best deck to be, and so maybe that will be Hammer again in due course, but not too surprising to see them giving Shadow a spin. I think the most notable thing in this top 8, other than, of course, the Timeless Dragon himself, Guillaume Raffetapa, showing up with a copy of Timeless Dragon in his blue-white, I guess... we have Fire Ice. We can call this a Jeskai control deck. We've got even got a Crumble to Dust there in the sideboard. I think it's fair at that point.
Yeah, if you're actually spending the red mana, it's definitely a Jeskai deck. There's Asparra's Headquarters in here, but without the Veil of Summer, we can't just call this 4-color control and confuse everybody.
Yeah, we're not calling every single deck that has Prismatic Ending in it a 5-color deck, because that gets out of control pretty quick. But no surprise to see Raffetapa just back doing his thing. And then I think the thing that really makes me raise an eyebrow here is Salai, Javier Dominguez, in this top 8 with the 4-color Vivian deck, which I know his good friend Andrea Mengucci has been singing the praises of and having a lot of fun on Twitter recounting his results with. And I you never know if this is a case of two incredibly accomplished players just taking a 4-color shell that has all of the good cards in it and then just embellishing it however they like, and you wonder which half of the deck is actually doing the work there. But seeing, you know, Mengucci and Javier Dominguez, I think Jeremy Dizani has been dipping his toe in this deck over in Japan. When you see that many notable players picking up a deck like this, I think you should take note as well.
Yeah, this deck has still managed to find its way to like the bottom of my to-do list. I think I have the other Elementals combo deck ahead of it, the Cascade deck, in terms of like things that I need to put a bit more time into. But I think that sort of speaks to the general direction that the Elementals decks have really had to adapt, and I think that this is sort of the direction that they're trying to go, where they are like a combo deck that is also a Risen Reef deck. And whether you're going with Glimpse of Tomorrow or with Vivian on the Hunt, either way, you're kind of accomplishing the same thing.
Yeah, the Vivian stuff in this deck feels like almost an afterthought, where we do have the one copy of Planebound Accomplice, we got the minimum there to kickstart the combo, but with that in mind, if you compare this to the 4 Accomplice, 4 Vivian builds that we saw at the start of that card's release, this deck is much less able to just fire off this turn 3 or turn 4 combo. Like, you have to Elodami's Call for the Accomplice and then resolve that and set all of that up, and you can in theory do that quickly with Utopia Sprawl, but that's a lot of hoops to jump through and a lot of stars that have to align in order to get that quick kill. And so this is almost a way to officially close out the game once you've established some semblance of control, and then you still have this remote chance of just getting this turn 3 kill out of nowhere in the faster matchups.
Yeah, it's more of like a tooth and nail that you eventually cast and win the game, and less of like a very proactive combo card.
I think my concern here would be, I don't know how much you're giving up with this approach against the various like Is It Plus decks. So Is It Murktide, Grixis Death Shadow, this kind of combo tends to be at its most fragile against those decks, and I think unless you're gaining enough elsewhere, which is not immediately clear to me, I don't know if this approach is worth it. Honestly, this may be a case of like, this deck has 4 copies of Utopia Sprawl. This might be a case of just having an incentive to go back to that card showcases how good that can be at parrying out, you know, turn 2 Risen Reef or turn 2 Teferi or setting up for turn 3 Omnath, and that ends up being the draw more so than any of the actual like specific variant stuff that's going on here. And we've seen this a lot with the various twists on 4 color. It's that there's this like one aspect to that twist that draws you in, and then the other stuff feels almost incidental. So with the Delirium build, if you want to call it that, you can label that as 4 color Traverse or what have you, but really this is 4 color Unholy Heat, and then Traverse just comes along for the ride. But if you had to cut it, then I don't think you would be too upset about it.
Yeah, that all makes sense, and I guess it's worth noting that, like, the cards that you were talking about, Is It, the cards you're cutting to fit in this combo are generally some of the cards that are worse against Is It. Now, you're still drawing a lot of, like, actually dead cards, which is dicey, but, it, you know, like, you're cutting, like, Counterspell or whatever from a normal 4-color deck, and that card's not the most exciting, or, like, all of the Furies from Elementals, more so, or things like that. So I think that this deck leans pretty heavily on, like, I have all the traditional 4-color stuff and a lot of one drop removal. Still going to have some issues, but maybe not as extreme as it might look at first glance.
Mm-hmm. Beyond that, we have a ton of Hammer throughout these results, and then a few copies of Merfolk, actually, kind of swimming around the fringes here.
Yeah, in two players that we've noted in the past, Coert, a long time, you know, back in the early days of the pod, the person who popularized Selesnya Heliod, and then Merfolk enthusiast Tulio Jowdy, with Yorian Merfolk, it looks like.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
There was a, when we were asking for submissions for the main topic this week of which bad matchups would you like to see covered in detail, there were a few suggestions of Merfolk versus X, and I kind of wrote this off because I don't know if Merfolk is popular enough or good enough or established enough to have any matchups worth going over in detail, but maybe that's changing. Maybe I'm behind the times here.
Well, one of the people asking was Tulio, so it's a little bit of chicken egg kind of thing going on here.
Okay, let's move over to the Sunday results quickly, where there isn't too much else going on beyond what we've mentioned. I guess the one thing to cover is the copy of Enchantress in the top 8. I haven't seen that in quite a while.
Yeah, I think the only really super interesting thing from this Sunday top 8, aside from Crusher winning everything, is you can see Nassif in the 31st place of the previous challenge with the hot new tech of Song of Creation combo, and then immediately dropping it, going back to Izzet, and top eighting the event.
Yeah, honestly, whatever the hot new deck is, you're probably better served just like playing Izzet Motai, playing Four Color, or playing Hammer, I guess, instead. But good to see that experimentation going on, and it has been fun to see on first on Canister stream, and then on the Sieves, and this kind of a back and forth exchange of trying to refine this Song of Creation deck, because I think we had featured this in a Nonsense of the Week segment a few weeks ago, and over that time, I think it has made the leap from Nonsense of the Week to kind of good-ish, like good adjacent, almost.
Yeah, it is an attempt at a combo deck that isn't Belcher, and it's sort of succeeding. It has a lot of acceptably good cards in it, so that's a start, but yeah, it's pretty bottlenecked, to be fair.
I have been very impressed by that deck's ability to force through its combo once you need to get it going between, like, Patron Negation and an Offer You Can't Refuse and Veil of Summer, which, Veil of Summer less so, but the other two are almost combo pieces that also help to just protect your namesake card. And so once you have Summon Creation, unless you're under a lot of pressure, if you have the resources ready to go, it's actually pretty trivial to force it through. The issue, as with many combo decks, from watching a lot of these streams, is just getting that Song of Creation in the first place. So I think some of the early discs had stuff like Communal Spirits, Serum Visions, was the kind of usual card smoothing effects. Later versions moved on to Glittering Wish, which is a really nice setup card, but you have the classic Wish issue of you have to relegate a copy of that card to your sideboard, and so you're not getting an extra four copies, you're only getting an extra three copies. And then there's not really any good ways to bolster that consistency beyond that. So you are capped in terms of just finding your namesake card and being able to defend it. But then once you can do that, I've been pretty impressed by the deck's ability to force it through and to start the chain going and to just spiral out of control from there.
Yeah, you did mention a card named Commune. Maybe we should talk about the card named Commune that showed up in this top eight as well. In a copy of Enchantress, top eighting this challenge.
Yeah, I really do love to see that. And Communal Spirits is a card that's tailor-made for this archetype, basically, where you can find either just the lands to keep making your land drops, or really, and Sithis itself actually is an enchantment. So you can find the Enchantress to keep the cards flowing there. Sanctum Weaver as well, you're one of your ideal turn two plays, also an enchantment. So this is basically the Ancient Stirrings to your Tron deck, essentially, in this archetype.
Yeah, I think there are, you know, there are six total cards that it cannot find in the 75, and two of those are the Commune with Spirits. So yeah, it's a pretty powerful selection here.
Yeah, I don't know if you're meant to almost be more all in on that card and just play the full four copies and have that stitch everything together. You do end up with some amount of diminishing returns at that point, but you know, very good to see this archetype kind of back on the map, if only for this weekend. Anything else from the Sunday results before we dive into the main segment?
Only thing worth noting was this constant living end debate of like which incarnations to play, and it looks like Sodek, the graveyard expert, has remained with grief. I'm on the side of liking the endurance and subtleties. Just I really like having a larger sideboard effectively by putting those in the main deck, but you know, to each their own. Also, I like the Big Turtle. I don't really know what else to say. That card's been really good in Living End. If you are not playing with Colossal Sky Turtle, I would give it a try.
Mm-hmm. So with that, let's get into the main segment here, making good time, and get into the very vague abstract headline of how to win your tough matchups.
Yeah, I think some of this is sort of interesting because a lot of the matchups among the Tier 1 Modern decks are close, and any toughness is just like, the decks are good, the matches are going to be close, and they're hard because they're close. So there's not like any headline, very disparate matchup there, but there's a lot once you start looking at the like Tier 2 decks, and then once you get the Pioneer, there are a decent amount more. Those matchups are a little more polarized.
Yeah, I think it is somewhat challenging to get anything out of the debate here, which is both useful enough in these specific matchups to be actionable there, but then is also broad enough that you can take this and apply it to whatever the matchup is that's causing you grief over in you know, Standard or Legacy or whatever format you encounter in the future.
Well, I think we've tried to do that with a few different case studies that have some broad applications. Let's start with one that I think is fairly straightforward, was definitely asked about, but it's the four-color versus Tron matchup. And this is like a pretty typical case of the matchup is bad because your opponent is doing something completely asymmetrical to what your deck is aiming to do. You're like casting Unholy Heat, and they're like, I'm just going to play a Wyrmcoil Engine over here. Do you want to Unholy Heat that, or?
Yeah, this is, like, if you go back a few years, a deck like Four Color is exactly the kind of thing that a deck like Tron is hoping to prey on. And I think one reason that we've seen Tron kind of recede from view for the most part is that the matchups that should be free-ish just aren't as free anymore, because those decks, the kind of soupy, good stuff decks, have picked up so many good tools that they can actually fight fair-ish. And if they're starting at, you know, 40% in the matchup instead of, you know, 30% or something even lower, then that's a good start. And then the matchup generally only gets better for the deck like Four Color, whatever it happens to be, after sideboarding there. So I think this is a tough matchup as opposed to the horror show that it was for, like, Blue-White Control circa 2017, for example.
Yeah, I think that the place to start with this is that I think that, like, everyone knows that you're supposed to Prismatic Ending an Expedition map. I think that people might be missing that it doesn't matter if their turn one artifact is a map or a star, you just kill it. Because otherwise, like, you can't take that ending with you. And this is, like, a pretty common thing where, like, if your opponent is an asymmetrically, like, they are playing a deck that is doing something and your deck is trying to trade and it can't really do that, you just take every chance to trade that you can. And, you know, killing their Chromatic Star on turn one might just, like, cut them off of turn two Sylvan Scrying. This is also, like, super important in the four-color versus burn matchup, where all you're doing is, like, can I exchange for a card at any given time? And then just, like, that will get me to the point of the game where maybe my Omnath or Solitude gets online and starts doing something relevant.
Yeah, if you have a matchup like this where the opponent's deck goes from, like, 0 to 60 in an instant once they have certain setup requirements that they've met, often if they are firing on all cylinders, then there's not really much you can do about it. So you have to take any opportunity to cut them off at the knees and stop that initial development. And so when you frame it in terms of, well, I'll use my Prismatic Ending that isn't going to have that many good targets on an Expedition map or even a Chromatic Star, that makes a lot of sense. I think it can be intuitive to most people. But even if it's more extreme, so this would come up for control decks with, like, a Force Negation, for example, right? Like, do you Force Negation the turn one Expedition map? Do you save the Force Negation for one of their payoff spells once they do assemble Tron? Like, that was always a classic dilemma. And I think that in general, if you have a sober view of just how difficult the matchup is once they get to do their thing, that is then going to inform how aggressive do I need to be in just stunting their development wherever possible and just tossing cards into the void to make sure that, you know, they can't get off the ground. So yeah, if they mulligan to five, for example, I'm going to seriously consider using my Force Negation on their Chromatic Star or what have you, even though that seems like a ludicrous idea on the surface, just because, like, making those asymmetric trades can even work in your favor when the reverse case on the back end is so dire if everything goes according to plan for them.
Yeah, the other big thing is that you should be looking for ways to, like, actually end the game. I know I have won my fair share of these style of matchups with Omnath by just planning a turn ahead and just going, like, Omnath, fetch land, not cracking it, untap, second fetch land, getting the extra 4 damage and just upping the clock a turn or whatever. And this is kind of just, like, a broad, like, the problem here is that if the game goes infinitely long, your opponent is just going to keep casting Ulamogs and you're going to die. And there's a lot of matchups like this. Someone had asked about, like, Jund versus Hardened Scales, where, like, in the end, they just have so many things that you cannot profitably kill that, like, trying to be a purely reactive deck, not going to work out so well. And Yawgmoth has a lot of the same problems. The thing I would look to in those matchups is, like, I'm just going to try to play a Ragavan hand and just become a tempo deck. This is, like, kind of been one of my bread and butters at the Pro Tour level, where, like, playing, like, Fairies or Jund or Obzon, like, you'll play against, you know, it was like Obzon versus Mono Green Devotion. You just attack them with Siege Rhino. Fairies versus Vengevine decks. You just attack them and tap the creature with Cryptic Command. Jund versus, like, Mono Red Burn. You just attack them with Putrid Leech and Blood Relief. There was no, like, the game going long was just going to be bad for you because you couldn't trade for their cards. So you just became the aggressor.
Yeah, and I think that is part of the appeal of some of these more proactive kind of combo control sub-variants of four color, whether it's the Bring to Light stuff or the Vivian stuff, where you actually have this plan where you can just end the game on turn four. And it's still probably not going to be enough to race their best draws or their fastest draws, but against their medium draw, or a draw from them that is trying to respect the threat of, what if they do, you know, Prismatic Ending my turn one Chromatic Sphere or something, then sometimes you can just steal games from underneath them that way. And I would actually lump in the Traverse list of four color too. I've been pretty impressed by how the plan of having four Baseju in their 75, you can just look at how the cards line up of, yeah, Baseju's good against Tron, but making this into an actual part of your plan where you can have pretty decent odds of having a Baseju when you need it, which is turn two a lot of the time, almost every game, and then you now have this lock that is always looming over the game of, what if they have a Ren and Six paired with their Baseju, or what if they have the second Baseju to follow up the first one. And so I like that even beyond just the sideboard mapping or whatever, you actually have this defined endgame that you can work towards now that also has the chance of just cutting them off at the knees if they have maybe exactly one route to turn three Tron, and you just have a Baseju on turn two, and that effectively is the entire game right there.
Yep. I think on the flip side of, like, doing the good thing, there's also some amount of, like, not accidentally keeping a hand or having cards in your deck that are doing bad things. Solitude comes to mind here, where it's like, oh, it can kill a Wyrmcoil Engine, and, like, it's a creature, it can attack. When is it ever doing something good? It doesn't. So, like, I think it's pretty easy in these matchups to say, like, oh, I have this card that could do something, and, like, you're mapping out the scenarios, and you're like, it never happens, does it? This is just not great. So, like, look for the cards that are, like, technically functional, but, like, not actually good, and do your best to get those out of your deck. Or also, like, when you're looking at an opening hand, just don't even, like, you'll get to the point where it's like, that is just not a card I care about. What do the other six cards do? This is basically a mulligan already.
Yeah, I would also say that the specifics of the end game that they're working towards matter a lot in terms of how aggressive you have to be at cutting them off early, where against some of the stock Tron lists that you see doing well online, and I can already tell this is going to be the bugbear that I come back to over and over again, if they're showing up with a pile of, like, Thrag Tusks and, you know, Wyrmcoil Engines against your Teferi Time Raveler Solitude deck, and if their payoffs are not actually reliable enough to win the game, then sometimes, if you can assess that risk ahead of time, you can let them get to that stage and know that you can actually trade off with their payoffs and just leave them with nothing going on, versus if you're against a Tron deck which is paying attention to how it actually has to close out the game in the matchup, and so they have a reliable route to Ulamog and or Emrakul, the Promised End, via Sanctum of Ugin, for example, or you know that Khan the Great Creator that's going on the stack can represent something like a Sundering Titan that can really cripple your whole development. Once you have to respect more of those threats, then that changes the earlier calculation of, like, do I want to counterspell that Sylvan Scrying, or, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, that all checks out. The end games do vary for some of these cases, and, like, there is some amount of knowing exactly how you are going to lose that is required in, like, understanding how to not lose.
Yeah, that principle, I think, also comes into play for a lot of the linear decks, which don't seem like they resemble a deck like Tron on the surface, but a deck like Yawgmoth in Modern, or really any of the classic Birds of Paradise plus Noble Hierarch, or in Pioneer, the Llanowar Elves plus Elvish Mystic decks. If you have a clear understanding of, you know, can I keep up with them in the mid game? Can I keep up with them in the end game? Is my deck well equipped to do that? Is my hand well equipped to do that? Well, that dilemma, which is as old as time, of do I bolt the bird, or, like, I guess, do I strangle the Elvish Mystic or something? Usually the answer is going to be yes, but I think that identifying those exceptions is often going to be the difference between, you know, just going through the motions in the matchup and actually, like, winning games that a lot of people would have lost in your seat.
Yeah, I know Tulio Jowdy had asked about Merfolk versus Yawgmoth, and my my immediate thought was, like, I am going to be Tide Shapering and Spreading Seizing every single black source I can, or green source. I'm just going to choose the color, and I'm going to try and see if I can Stone Rain them off that. Like, if your opponent doesn't get to play Magic, you have probably won the game. So when you're trying to flip these matchups where you just can't interact with them, if you get your chance to Stone Rain them.
That's often a fun sub-goal, even if you're not quite as dedicated as, like, an April King or what have you. But there are some matchups where, like, that legitimately is your primary strategic plan, and you just have to pursue that at all costs.
Yeah, the picture of Corticals in 2X Masters Limited, turn 3 Flicker Wisping, his opponent's turn 2 Bounce Land, just... chef's kiss. That's it. That's the game. You're done. That's all you're looking for in life. I think there's, like, one other matchup to highlight here that's just, like, you kind of have to think about the same way, which is Phoenix versus Lotus Field in Pioneer, where, like, you just, you're like, I have to cast 3 spells with Phoenix. And as soon as your opponent casts an Arboreal Grazer in that matchup, you should look at your hand and be like, I'm going to be casting a Lightning Axe and in response casting a Fiery Impulse on that. That's what's going to happen this game, and you've got to create those, like, scenarios where just, like, this card's doing nothing, I'm throwing it away to get a spell trigger on my Thing in the Ice or whatever, because that's how the game ends.
Yeah, I think this is more of a tactical thing than a matchup thing, but sometimes this will come up a lot against decks with Delve cards, or where you're trying to string together a bunch of spells in a particular turn, where your opponent has a bunch of cards and seemingly a bunch of resources, and they're not really doing anything. And often the most likely explanation for that is some of those cards are conditional interaction, which if you give them a chance to use that, well, your card is not doing anything anymore because they just die to their face-up Lightning Axe. But then giving them a chance to do that in turn is going to enable the third spell for Arclight Phoenix, or it's the card in the graveyard for Treasure Cruise, or what have you. I think I've used this parallel before, but in Standard, when, you know, you had these control decks and so on powered by Dig Through Time, often the best approach was to just not cast your spells. Like, don't give them a chance to trade one for one early, because in doing so, you're just letting them bridge the gap to the Dig Through Time, which then bridges the gap to the next phase of the game. If you just don't give them a chance to do that, well, often you are actually better at playing the waiting game than they are. So identifying those spots where, like, okay, I can kind of sniff out the interaction that's there. Is it even worth baiting that out now? Because often the logic is, well, if I don't, then they're always going to have it. This isn't getting any better. Why not just get through the card now and set up for a future turn? Sometimes the reason why you shouldn't do that is because doing that just opens the floodgates for something terrifying and unknown that you're not aware of yet.
Yeah, well, actually, there's a matchup on here later that I'll bring this up in again, but... yeah, that is, like, a pretty important tactic when you're talking about instant speed card draw, is timing your spells against that. Mm-hmm. Moving on to kind of the flip case, a matchup that I know has been a hot topic of debate among people I know is, especially Andrew Ellenbogen, Pioneer Mono Blue Spirits against basically all the aggro decks. And this is a pretty big case of, like, what do your winning games look like when your Spirits deck defeats these other decks that are, like, going under it, technically faster than it, and filled with more interaction. The answer is really just, like, you deploy your creatures, they miss on killing them, and then something you do goes over the top, and you just get to, like, play your game of, like, okay, well, this is going to chump block here, I'm going to be at, like, one life, and you're going to be at -1 at the end of the game, because I have 12 power or whatever. I think an important thing to realize for this is that, like, when you are in the position of being behind, wanting to interact, but having limited interaction, sometimes you just kind of have to ask where, like, especially in these, like, heavy creature matchups, like, well, if I just sit around and wait, am I actually getting somewhere? And, like, if they have the thing that's going to beat me, am I actually beating it by waiting around, or am I just going to lose later anyways? This is kind of how, like, the Spirits deck has to approach the Boros Heroic matchup, where, like, yeah, your opponent might just have a Virtuoso. They might just have, like, they have landed a Virtuoso on the play. They might just have, like, you know, Homestead Courage Rampage, and you die. But, like, if they don't, you could probably win that game. What can you do to win the games where they don't have it? And then if you just sit around, like, are you really getting anywhere? Or are they just going to, like, draw another lane and do this whole thing with God's Willing up? So, like, there's a point where you're just, like, part of the bad thing has happened. I now have to take risks and hope that the rest of the bad thing doesn't happen to me.
The Spirits case is intriguing because you also have this potential for this endgame opposition lock almost via Shacklegeist, where there's this weird intersection where they have just enough creatures that they can Shacklegeist lock you out of the game, but not enough that the Shacklegeist itself is irrelevant because they can just turn everything sideways and get you dead regardless. So you find these weird spots in the middle where that can come up, but yeah, but by and large, it's just a classic example of I am a tempered deck. My entire raison d'etre is either playing from ahead or identifying like this one turn window where the game seemingly is close or at parity, but I get this good trade in here, or you walk into the wrong piece of interaction here, and suddenly I'm ahead, and now that I have that advantage, I can keep pressing it, and all of my cards work towards that goal. But one thing which I don't know if you think is appropriate to lump it in here, but there was, I guess, just fairies, like as a deck, as a concept, but more broadly, there was this entire stretch of a few years in Standard, and then also like Extended of various sizes as well, where just the planning around Crypto Command was like such a big part of the game, where that was a card that really put you in this bind of, well, if I run into it, then this bad thing happens. If I try and play around it, then I'm just allowing this other bad thing to happen. And sometimes there was an explicit pincer like that. So the classic Mistbind Cleek versus Crypto Command dilemma. But sometimes it was just like, this card is going to do something against me no matter what. And if I overthink myself and like contort my plan around playing around this one bad outcome, then there's this entire like other branch of the decision tree, which is equally bad for me, if not more so, and I'm just allowing that to flourish for no good reason.
Yeah, I think fairies is kind of cheating here, because the fairies player like knew your entire hand at all times, and also got to take the second action at all times, and also like all their cards were both proactive and interaction. So there was like, that's just like the hyper extreme of this, where like almost it was just a bad matchup for everybody, where it's just like, I don't know, I gotta take a game action. And I think that like what it almost flips like who has to be the tempo deck when that hits that kind of extreme, where like you know, imagine you have reached the spot of the game with your aggro deck where the Spirits deck has started to build some kind of advantage, or is looking to. The thing you should be doing is like, what is the thing I can do to force the worst play out of them? And taking that line while you're ahead. And then once you're behind, just like, well, if they don't have it, they'll like just taking the plays that win if they don't have the exact thing. Or like, maybe not necessarily that extreme, because you might have a little bit of wiggle room, but like as you fall behind, you should start shifting your plays to be more and more aggressive.
Yeah, maybe a better example for my point would be like the Standard Merfolk decks that had Cryptic Command, and that was really their only kind of vector of interaction, where yeah, sometimes they would Aggrotex will your land and then all of their stuff is unblockable or something like that, but for the most part they were just adding power to the board and trying to do that faster than whatever you were doing. And then Cryptic Command was like the one thing that could bust those races open, or allow them to win from a spot where basically no other card in the format, or maybe even Magic, could reverse their fortunes. And just knowing how to play against this one card, which in turn had this entire range of outcomes, was one of the most essential skills in that format. And going back from that, it made it difficult to evaluate, like, how good is the matchup for, like, Black-Green Elves against Merfolk, for example? And the answer is, well, it's somewhere in the, like, it seems pretty close. It's somewhere in the range of 55, 45 in one direction. But so much of that last 5 to 10% was tied up in, like, how good is one player at either leveraging their own Cryptic Commands or the threat of that, or playing against the threat of Cryptic Command from the other side?
Yeah, I think to fast forward this to the future, I think there's an important aspect that we kind of talk about between those two things, which is, like, if you are playing the tempo side, one of the things you should do is try to fork your opponent between playing around different options. You know, we talked about that Merfolk case where they just have one exact instant threat. Pretty easy for people to kind of maneuver their way through that. If you can start saying, like, putting people in this bind of, like, well, what if they have Rattle Chains? What if they have Brazen Borrower? What if they have Geistlight Snare? Like, they have all these things they could have. This is going to be a giant mess. Oh no, they control a Rattle Chains. They could do anything. That's the spots where you're going to get a lot of equity and win games, because your opponent has to consider, like, you know, 15 different permutations of things, and then you might actually have, like, three or four of those to select from.
Yeah, this is where, in terms of deck choice, I think you have to be on top of things in gauging how good the field at large is at playing around this, like, web of possible cards, and then how much of your deck's effectiveness is tied up in that. So when we think about the various takes on Spirits and Pioneer, so Mono Blue Spirits, Blue White Spirits, Bant Spirits, a deck like Bant Spirits has enough raw power where, yeah, sometimes you just go, like, Lord into Collected Company for two more Spirits and just overpower whatever's going on, and there's not much back and forth either way, versus those really close games where with Mono Blue Spirits where both of you are, like, walking this tightrope, and if they play around the wrong thing at the wrong time, or if you take your guard down at the wrong time, then that can be the entire game right there. And I think one reason maybe that you've seen less Mono Blue Spirits in some of the online Pioneer tournaments in recent weeks is, like, the deck is lower in raw power than something like Blue White or Bant Spirits, but is better at putting the opponent to the test in that way. And if the opponent just becomes better at passing that test, then that's enough to change some of the incentives at work in terms of, should I be playing this deck in the first place?
That makes some sense. Flipping back to the tempo side, there's just, like, one last point I want to touch on, which is don't trick yourself into sideboarding. Like, we were talking about, like, these reactive cards and forcing people to play around them. Unless a, like, hyper-conditional card is a very specific answer to, like, your opponent's absolute best thing, don't trick yourself into sideboarding it in just because it does something. Like, Aether Gust against Boros Heroic, I could not imagine wanting that. Like, what's it going to do? It's going to hit, like, Swift Spear and, like, two of their tricks? Just, like, those kind of sideboard decisions where it's just, like, this might interact. That sounds good. It's like, no. You should, like, have a broad plan of interaction and, like, a plan to utilize this card that reliably comes up in the games. Or also, like, don't bring in cards that put yourself out of position. Aether Sphere Harvester is a big one in matchups where, like, the 3-5 lifelink is not the best blocker. Like, that kind of stuff where, like, you should be focusing on, like, the ways you win are being very proactive and just somehow assembling this board that is full of everything and additive, or, like, getting into the spot where your trick lines up against whatever they do on a turn, and not focusing on, like, one specific narrow case happening.
Yeah, Aether Gust is part of this class of cards which get pigeonholed as cyborg cards, but we've seen them show up more and more in main decks because various formats were warped to the point where, in terms of their color distribution, where that made sense, right? So we've seen a lot of main deck Aether Gust formats, main deck Mystical Dispute formats, and trying to recalibrate when those cards are actually good and when they should be strictly cyborg cards for very specific matchups can be a little difficult. So, yeah, against a deck like Heroic, where this card is a conditional 2-mana piece of removal, there's not even a permanent piece of removal against some fraction of their cards. Like, that is just not worth it if you have any other decent alternative. And then on the flip side, you have weird cases like, I know in Standard, some of the Reclamation decks were either keeping in or boarding in more copies of Mystical Dispute against a deck like Jund Sacrifice, for example, because the theory being the way I lose this matchup for the most part is I get overpowered by a fast Korvold or a fast Bolas of Citadel, and this is not an impressive way on rate to contest that, but it is a way to contest that, and the rest of my deck just has them outmatched on all the other angles, and so that's the only thing I need to fill the hole in.
Yeah, I tweeted about this, how, like, the fact that I played so much of, like, late-stage, Eldraine War Standard, it's just like, oh, I'm playing with these same Aether Gust Mystical Dispute interactions, like, 2 years later, and, like, it's just the same things over and over, and I know how to do these things, you know, better than the vast majority of people. Like, I don't know. We could talk about that for a long time, because there's just, like, so many little touches of, like, what to do with Dispute and Aether Gust. And my advice is, like, some of it you just got to feel out over time, how to like, you know, sprinkle those two cards into your sideboard plans when it's not really obvious that they're good. But I guess that's kind of a, like, think about them a little more in spots where they are high, like, when them resolving is, like, secretly high impact, and then think about them a little less when they are, like, likely to target something but not be high impact. I don't know. That's kind of a weird roundabout statement, but yeah.
Yeah, I think that might be a good topic to devote an episode to when nothing else presents itself for the week, and you know, we feel like diving into something more theoretical there. Let's get to a class of matchups which we see across a lot of the major formats at the moment, and that would be these aggro combo decks, if you like, versus these removal heavy interactive decks. So that might be Heroic against the black red 3-drop deck in Pioneer, or like Hammer versus Murktide or 4-color in Modern, for example.
Yeah, I put these here because I lump them in the same category as like mono blue versus aggro, where it's the same kind of thing where like you have to assemble something before your opponent gets to the point of the game where, like, in the aggro case, it's the Blue Spirits deck just dying. In the Rakdos or 4-color case, it's the point where, like, oh, their spells are just all better than mine. And you're worrying about, like, assembling this thing while also not losing to, like, getting run out, like, whatever bad interaction happens, whether it's them, like, actually killing you with the aggro decks versus blue, or whether it's just, like, the bad removal thing happening to you when you're the aggro combo deck. And I think you have the same kind of thing where it's, like, That situation between, like, blue and, like, Boros, where it's, like, they have resolved an Illuminator Virtuoso, what are you going to do? That equivalent comes up when you're playing these, like, aggro combo decks, where it's, like, your opponent has passed with mana up. What are you going to do? And the question is, like, often, especially in these spots where, like, you don't necessarily have a lot of protection, though, like, Blacksmith's Heel coming back into Hammer makes this a little more interesting. It's, like, well, if I wait another turn, does the game get better for me? I think in Boros versus Rakdos, like the Pioneer examples of this, it actually is relatively okay to wait as long as you can, like, make sure they can't, like, end of turn removal spell, untap, play a threat. Because all their threats are just so freaking expensive that, like, they have to commit so much mana that you actually have an opening after they resolve. I think in Modern, just because, like, the 4-color spells are basically free, and their threats are also free, you don't have that same luxury, and you should be, when you're talking about, like, well, what could I do to recombo or whatever, like, you should be thinking, like, well, if I have a second hammer next turn, I could just respond to an Unholy Heap with another hammer or whatever. Like, those are the things you should be looking for, and not just, like, broadly waiting, unless there's a direct action that broadly waiting gets you. Or if you have Urza Saga, in which case you can just be like, well, you know, I'm still working on killing them. It's just not committing all my resources to doing it.
I think one way you can get an edge in these matchups generally is to pretend like you're engaging them on their terms. So in Hammer against, you know, 4-color or Murktide, for example, if you can act like the game is one where just trading one for one is going to leave them in a good position when the dust settles, but you have this one thing left over, and that might be, you know, back in the day, it was Lurrus, which was face up and always looming over the game, and so there wasn't quite the same element of trickery involved, and that was more about, like, forcing them to use their interaction on early stuff to clear the way for Lurrus, but it might be something like an Urza Saga instead, right? Where if you're playing this small, low-resource game, and you have the Urza Saga, then they need something pretty good to compete with that. Or, like, the Reality Chip in some of the Blue Hammer versions that we see now. If you can act like you are playing the game they want to play, but you just beat them at their own game, then that can sometimes be a good way to kind of flip the script on them. That is one of my criticisms, actually, of the Boros deck in Pioneer, is that it doesn't really have a good way of doing that, because the essence of the deck is I take a creature which is not impressive by itself, and then I pile up all of these counters and triggers and effects on it, and then that gets it to the point where they have to take it seriously. And so if everything trades down and you're left with like one creature and one spell, well, that creature probably is not going to be very good, and there's no way to kind of go back up on cards or to have one like really good thing left over when the dust settles. So from the Rakdos side, you can just point and click your removal at anything that moves, ideally with, you know, if you can bait them into using one combat trick or something on it first, then that's ideal. But from the Rakdos side, that is a plan you can pursue. Whereas I think the Hammer deck is, I mean, naturally, just given the card pool and so on, it is more fundamentally sound in the sense of you can threaten this incredibly fast kill, but then also present this second wave that can bob and weave around just the next Fatal Push or the next Unholy Heat or something.
Yeah, I think that what I highlighted with like mana efficiency is really where the Boros deck has to push its edge, because it's less unlike the Virtuosos, which you are like, yeah, maybe getting a connive out of, and more on the fact that you're just like, okay, I'm going to play, like, the hands that are going to win are going to be the ones that have, like, Swift Spear, 10th District Legionnaire, and a Favorite Hoplite, and my opponent does not have enough ways to kill those for one mana, and then I will try to line up every single God's Willing I can with a card that costs more than God's Willing, and maybe the fact that I am taking, you know, 6 game actions by turn 3 and they're taking 2 will put me in a spot where they just, like, die.
Yeah, or sometimes you have this this motley crew of, like, a 1-2 Favorite Hoplite and a Swift Spear and, like, a 2-2 Legionnaire or 1-1 Virtuoso, and you have those and you just attack and you don't do anything. You don't set up a spot where you go for a trick and they have the removal and then they get anything back out of that interaction. And if you, sometimes this is, it is easy to set this up because they're just like passing the turn without doing anything, and they're clearly holding up some kind of conditional card. Sometimes you just get to make them waste their mana every turn and not give them a chance to use that by not playing into it, by just attacking for 2, attacking for 3, and eventually you get to the point where they kind of have to use that card proactively, and then you can just unload your entire handful of tricks with protection on whatever the one thing you have left over.
Yeah. This is also like a spot where, like, sometimes getting in that first, like, half of Homestead Courage on a Favorite Hoplite or whatever is pretty big, because the clock suddenly goes from, like, I'm taking 2 damage a turn, I'll figure it out on turn 7, to, like, oh, I'm taking 4 damage, and I should probably figure this out within the next 2 turns.
Mm-hmm. Let's get into some specific matchups in Modern, then. And I think the one that is really the talk of the town right now, and will be until something fundamental in the format changes, is Murktide against 4-color. And the consensus, certainly from a lot of the 4-color diehards, is the Murktide matchup is very good, and this is one of the main reasons to play 4-color. And from the Murktide side, a lot of the Murktide pilots seem to agree that the matchup is bad, but not quite that bad. And it is at least winnable, and against a lot of 4-color players, you will find opportunities for a player difference, I think is the polite phrase to come into play.
Yeah, I think that the best way to describe this is that it's very similar to, like, those difficult aggro combo versus, like, mid-range decks, where, like, there are a lot of ways to instantly lose the game from the Izzet side. But, like, also, if you look at the results, like, how could Izzet put up, you know, we talked about Hammer having a good weekend. Izzet was, like, what? You know, there's 2 top 8s in it, like, 4 or 5 decks in those 2 top 8s. How could it be winning so much if 4-color was that bad of a matchup? It just couldn't. And I think that the Izzet deck is... I used to say that Hammer was the most difficult deck in Modern. I've come around to the latest builds of Izzet approaching it in terms of just, like, outright difficulty, just because of the way that they're built between Roggevant, Shredder, and Murktide. You just have a lot of ability to flex your threats against removal in terms of, like, getting them in good in, like, spots where it's like, this is going to be, like, a 7-7 against Heat, or, like, I'm going to cash in this, you know, loot, or just, like, dodging removal with how you are, like, dashing Roggevant, like, all these things like that. that, like, a lot of it's really contextual. And the thing here that I wrote is, like, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You can just go to the internet and look for a good Izzet player and just, like, watch them play the games. I would not, like, this is very specifically for a matchup that is tough, but, like, the very good players are winning. You should just look at what the good players are doing and see if you can just, like, see into the Matrix by watching them.
I would go to Nassif's Twitch channel and find the VOD from the Modern Challenge this past weekend and maybe speed it up a bit and maybe do that hack you mentioned where you get to increase it even past the 2x speed, and then I would just try and absorb that into my brain however I could. And yeah, I think just learning by watching and maybe getting those repetitions in yourself is a good way to do that. I will say, from not having much direct experience in the matchup, but watching it a decent amount, is the games that Murktide wins, you come away thinking that, like, surely the matchup can't be that bad, because every exchange that's going on, it's like the Murktide player is winning either on mana or cards or both sometimes, and the four-color player is constantly behind the eight ball, and when you frame it in those terms, it really is reminiscent of just the spirits against whatever matchup that we mentioned in Pioneer or some of these tempo decks in the past. I think that it's... But at the same time, you sometimes have this almost like Psychotog-esque play pattern of we have these early fights and maybe you lose this battle, but you kind of regroup over here, and then on turn like 6 or 7, you just play Murktide Regent with Counterspell backup, and that actually is enough to ice the game from that point. So... The fact that the interaction in the four color deck is plentiful and it's good, but it all has its own weaknesses that you can punch through, and you just have to identify which of those weak points you can try to exploit in any given game and just drive hard through those. So yeah, if you can force them to pitch cast a Solitude on your Ragavan, usually you're pretty happy about that. Or if you can engineer a spot where, like, they're tapping low to try and Prismatic Ending your Ledger Shredder or something, and you get to re-trump that with something else. Like, finding ways to dictate the pace of the game in that way, I think, is the name of the game from the Murktide side. And then from the four-color side, you just... I don't know, you just... It's simplistic to say you just play your cards, but you just don't make yourself exploitable in that sense. I don't know if there's a better way to phrase that.
No, that is one of the reasons this matchup is so hard, is because the four-color player can play at, like, 80% proficiency, or, like, not even 80, like, 70% proficiency, and be pretty close to 100, whereas the Izzet player playing at, like, 70% proficiency is going to lose 30% of their win percentage on the spot. They're just going to, like, have an actual bad matchup. They have to play at, like, 90%. It's tough. It's also, like, really weird because, like, if you went to, like, the quadrant theory of, like, okay, so there's fast games that resolve and slow games, and then games that resolve where, like, people have one thing, and then games where people have a lot of things. If you just pointed to a square on the quadrant and asked who won, the answer is, I have no freaking clue, because either deck could be, like, way ahead early, or, like, either deck could come down to the point where it's like, oh yeah, one of us cast Expressive Iteration on turn 12, and then the other player didn't have a thing and they died. It's like, well, who did it? I don't know. Someone. So, like, it's just a very arduous matchup on a lot of levels. I think a lot of the Izzet matches are just that way in general, because your cards are, like, simultaneously, like, very powerful, but very exposed, but also, like, you have a lot of flexibility in how you play them to make them less exposed, and, like, every single game and match is just a giant mess, and you're just scraping to be, like, 55 to 60% in every single matchup on your good days. If you play Izzet, you are signing up for hard mode. I will just say that.
Yeah, I think the issue, or one of several issues, is that those weaknesses you're trying to exploit don't really have much overlap. So if you're trying to exploit the relative inefficiency of the four-color deck, so all your cards are super cheap from the Murktide side, you can back those up with a cheap interaction, your iterations are a little better because your curve is lower, so you can fire them off earlier and just kind of keep the pressure going, then that is really good against, like, Sorcery Speed Prismatic Ending, or if they're out to your big thing is Teferi and trying to bounce it, and you can re-trump that with a counterspell. But that whole philosophy breaks down when they can just, like, pitch cast Solitude and then immediately claw their way back in with some other expensive card on their own turn, and now the ball is in your court again. Or on the flip side, like, if you're trying to respect the threat of solitude and kind of slow down your own pacing, well, now you're opening up more room for their clunky cards to kind of have relevance in the game going long. So it's really tough to thread the needle against all of that at the same time. And this is the kind of matchup where you would love to cheat, almost, to kind of artificially just gain yourself some equity with some gangbusters cyborg card. So I think the hope was that, like, the Blood Moon effects that you see in Murktide cyborgs anyway could do that in the matchup, and they can sometimes, but it doesn't seem super reliable. It feels like you have to kind of get away with something in order to get them with Blood Moon a lot of the time. And then you almost want the equivalent of like Torak in the shadow deck for the four color matchup, but I don't know what in the Izzet colors can really offer to do that, if anything.
Yeah, and Blood Moon has this like weird problem where you lock yourself out of blue spells. Like, it's very, you can't cast Murktide Regen plus counterspell under a Blood Moon most of the time. I don't even know, the stock Izzet deck has three islands, so you cannot cast counterspell and Murktide Regen in the same turn if you Blood Moon. So, like, yeah, it's, you don't get the free wins. It's just, sometimes the answer to how do I fix a tough matchup is get good. Unfortunately, this is one of those cases.
Yeah, I don't know what more we can really offer on top of that. So let's go on to another matchup, which I think everyone agrees from both sides is pretty catastrophic, but also there doesn't seem to be a clear way to fix it, and that is Yawgmoth against Crashing Footfalls. So
it's
the
bad.
Issue here, I mean, there is a long laundry list of issues, but really the issue is all of the interaction on the Footfall side is pretty good. So, like, all of your small removal is good against all of their small creatures, but then also, like, your Force Negation is good against their Eldritch Evolution or even their Call of Calling some amount of the time. You know, your Subtlety is also, like, phenomenal. And you're placing enough pressure on them with two separate trampling creatures that it's not even easy to block with your Undying stuff and buy a few turns by soaking up damage. Like, that just doesn't really work. And so your life total is under enough pressure that even if you can fight through all of that and then sick Yawgmoth, you often just don't have much room to actually do anything with it or to attempt to go off. And the attempt to play that kind of a fair-ish beatdown plan where, like, your Strangaroo Geist or your Endurance or whatever is going all the way just is not really sustainable against a pair of 4/4s. So it feels like, just on the fundamentals, every part of the matchup is bad, and there's no clear way to address, certainly not all of it at the same time, but even any one of those weaknesses.
Yeah, this matchup is like the definition of an unfixable bad matchup, and it showcases the two ways that happens. One is, the closer your opponent's deck is to deterministic, the more likely it's just to be unfixable. The classic case is Burn versus Dredge, where it's just like, okay, so they're gonna put half of their deck into their graveyard every game, and they're gonna hit some Creeping Chills every game, and you're like, okay, so what if all their Creeping Chills are in their bottom 15 cards? Maybe I have a shot. So, like, that's, like, where we're at with, like, okay, so they have 8 Cascade spells, or they can suspend Footfalls. So they're just always going to have 4/4s, and you're like, okay, I can't beat those basically ever. And then beyond that, you have the second issue, which is that, like, there are layers of issues here. We're like, okay, so maybe their main plan doesn't work. They have a hand without Cascade. All their Disruption is still really freaking good, and they'll eventually do the thing. I'm trying to, like, there's a lot of, like, classic cases of, like, combo decks having layered issues against, like, I don't know, I'm thinking, like, the Counterbalance top decks. It's like, okay, so my opponent has not resolved Counterbalance in top. I'm continuing to play the game. Their deck is full of Force Negation, or, like, Force Wills and Spell Snares and Counterspells. That's not great, is it? So, like, those are the two issues that make a matchup, like, absolutely unfixable. Or, I guess the one that isn't popping up here, which is the reverse of, like, if rather than their deck being deterministic, your deck's deterministic. So this is like Tron in Modern, where, like, you can't, like, turn 3 happens and you are casting your spell, and that's the first point you have to do anything. Or, like, Lotus Field in Pioneer, really big example of this, because it's like, what do you, it's, you know, turn 4 is the earliest you can do anything relevant, and if your opponent's just, like, gonna kill you before turn 4, you're gonna die. in like Tron, like if your opponent is just like Burn or Hammer, like the Calibrated Blast versus Hammer matchup, another great example of this. Calibrated Blast not going to kill the Hammer player in any time frame that is relevant for the Hammer player. They're just going to be out of the game. It's going to be done. So like those are the points where you're kind of like, well, I either just say this matchup is unwinnable or I can take drastic action. So going back to like that Burn versus Dredge example, there are two options. You could either do nothing and hope to dodge, which was my plan of choice when I was playing Dredge, or playing Burn. Or you can take half of your sideboard, you can find 8 cards that one-shot beat your opponent, and shuffle them into your deck, and hope that that covers it. Just become, you are not a Burn deck, you are now a Leyline of the Void deck. None of your other cards actually matter, you are just a completely different deck. It's a transformational sideboard where the transformation is some stupid 8 card. In the case of Yawgmoth versus Footfalls, that just doesn't exist. Like, you can't do that. But, like, that's the tactics you have to consider before you give up. Like, the matchup can legit be unfixable, and the answer can just be give up. Like, that's not outrageous, but, like, make sure it falls into one of these categories of, like, deterministic things happening every game or, like, layers of issues before you start considering, yeah, maybe this is just utterly unfixable.
I think it is an issue with some of those more gimmicky or all-in combo decks like Calibrated Blast, where you're kind of capped on both speed and resources, and you have these deck body constraints where even if you could board in a bunch of... I don't even know what it would be in this case, but you have your Calibrated Blast deck, and you can board in a certain number of Force of Vigors, Engineered Explosives, I don't even know. What is that actually doing for you? Like, if you set up your sideboard card, you get this off, and then you just don't have Calibrated Blast in your draw. Well, you do nothing and you die anyway. Great. Or sometimes if just having those cards in your deck or in your draw impedes the basic functioning of your deck in the first place. Like, I don't know if there is a realistic sideboard card you could have, like a sideboard spell with Calibrated Blast, where you are happy to actually blast and reveal that thing. Like, if explosives might be the most extreme case, but like, okay, you just actually just deal nothing. But I that kind of goes across the board. And so sometimes, yeah, you just give up. You realize that, okay, I am capped in how good I can ever be in this matchup. And so I will take my 35 to 40% of the bank and just suck it up because I think my matchups across the board elsewhere are good enough to make that trade-off worth it. And I think you have, if you're playing one of these decks in the first place, this is part of the trade-off that you are signing up for there. With something like Yawgmoth versus Footfalls, it seems like it should be more fixable, because even though there is no one thing, like, for example, there's no one creature you can Call of Calling or Evolution for, especially in a relevant time frame, that really just ends the game against Footfalls. There's Dranith Magistrate, kind of, that we mentioned earlier, and we have seen Yawgmoth decks having a light splash of white for that card in the past, but by and large, that is not really an avenue you have to go down, so you have to fight fair, almost. You have to board in a sideboard card and draw it and have it be good enough, and then need the rest of the game to break away from there. And so I guess one way you could do that is to directly attack their way of applying pressure. So, you know, a card like Necromancer, which is not there for the Rhino's matchup, but I presumably if it's there in your sideboard, you board it in, and some number of games you will get to Necromancer their Crashing Footfalls off an Ignoble Hierarch or something, and that will actually be enough to reduce the game to this crawl where they have to win with their Brazen Borrower or their Bonecrusher Giant, and the rest of your deck actually is pretty well equipped to handle that past that point.
Yeah, that's a great example of just, like, hoping it works out and taking your shot, but, like, there's not enough cards that do that to dedicate a bunch of slots to it, and you just kind of are like, well, if it's there, it's there, and I am largely not worrying about the matchup, but if I get the thing that wins the game, then that's cool.
Yeah, the Footfalls matchup is a weird example where you almost wish you had one of these, like, really big fair cards. So I am thinking back to before MH2, where there was a Yawgmoth list that had like Elder Gargaroth and Cyborg or something. You kind of just want a big thing that can brawl and actually outmatch Rhinos on the ground without the setup requirements of I need to get Yawgmoth in play, and I need to pay all this life and be shuffling these undying creatures between zones. You kind of just want a big, dumb idiot that can get the game over with, and one issue is no such idiot is really readily available.
Yeah, and even then it's just like, okay, so I'm going to cast Dead Gone, and then you're going to take 8, and then you're going to cast that again, and then you're just going to be at, like, 2 life.
Yeah, you kind of long for the days of, like, Cavalier of Night, or some of the really, like, arcane stuff from the early builds of the deck, where it felt like you had more time to just mess around with random nonsense.
Yeah. Speaking of Footfalls, it has its own problem matchup in this case, and I wanted to highlight this because it's a example of, like, a lot of these things are sort of true, but they're not, and you can work around them in some cases, and that's Footfalls versus Living End, where, like, it's like, okay, so both players are going to resolve their Cascade spells, the Footfalls player is going to take their tokens and not even put them in the graveyard, they're just going to go back into the deck box, and then the Living End player is going to have 20 power. And it's just both people doing the same thing, no one can undercut each other, so what can you do as the Footfalls player to try to win these games? Well, the first stop is, we mentioned this already, but the thing about making your hate cards less predictable, pretty important. So, like, whether you have Endurance or Leyline of the Void drastically changes how the Living End player has to adapt, because just two different cards interact with those. You know, Endurance, they can just board in a pile of subtleties. Leyline, they board in all their Brazen Borrowers. The more you can make that a decision for them is pretty important, so, like, if you are going to have 4 Endurances in your Footfall 75, you might do better to have a Leyline and 3 Endurances or something like that. Another thing is kind of understanding that, like, it's very possible to get in a single hit with Footfalls tokens. So playing games where you are trying to close the gap between, okay, I've resolved Shardless Agent and I'm going to attack once. If they're, you know, if I deal 10, they fetch, maybe I can, like, sneak in a couple extra damage with, like, a Borrower and, like, a Bonecrusher Giant and close it out. So trying to play those games. And then I guess another matchup that's sort of similar in this kind of, like, what can I do to win despite, like, being unable to fix the core problem of the matchup is Hammer versus Yawgmoth, where it's just like, oh, if they resolve a Yawgmoth, this isn't happening. It's just done. All my cards are dead. They draw their entire deck. Whatever. So you just gotta play to beat them before that happens. It's just like, there's a specific endpoint of the game. You cannot let them get to that endpoint. And, you know, even getting a Pithing Needle, not going to fix it. Like, they'll just force a Vigor Pithing Needle, because that's what's happening. So, like, when things get this, like, in this sense of unfixable, and this also still applies to Yawgmoth versus Footfalls, is, like, you just got to take your best shot of, like, well, I'm just going to try to win the game in the most efficient way and, like, best way possible, and not keep my hands that don't do that.
I think that's an example where the stakes are pretty clear, and it kind of ties into the earlier point of, like, if I do my thing and they do their thing is just so much better, and it directly trumps my thing, the way that Living End just interacts with any board presence I have, and even the minimal Living End. If they resolve Living End for, like, Striped Riverbinder and Curator of Mysteries, that just beats my follow-up Shardless Agent into Crouching Footfalls straight up. And so I either have to go out of my way to disable their thing, whether it's Endurance or Leyline, or ideally both. If I was playing Rhinos in a field that I expected to have a lot of Living End, I would want both of those cards in my 75, and ideally more than 4 total copies of those cards. Sometimes you're going to get that lineup of their Cascade spell is Shardless Agent, and you get to Force Negation it, and then this is where what you were saying about, like, closing the window so that I only need 1 Rhino's hit instead of 2, so that their follow-up Shardless Agent doesn't have time to be relevant anymore. That's where that really comes into play. And then, yeah, with something like Hammer versus Yawgmoth, it's another case where the stakes are different, but I think equally clear, and it's that, like, past a certain point, their deck just has mine snookered, and so I have to exploit the relative advantage that Hammer has, certainly over Yawgmoth, but also just over most decks as a whole, of that speed and efficiency, and just drive that angle home as hard as possible. And in my experience, like, the Yawgmoth matchup, or rather, Yawgmoth does have a good Hammer matchup, but it's not the blowout that you will often hear it advertised as, just because, like, my deck is a little clunky, I need both specific cards, and then I need to get up to 4 mana or certain base of resources to do my thing, and that's just not trivial against the, you know, the top 30% or what have you of hammer draws.
Yeah, the Ogmoth deck certainly has a fail rate too that like bakes into all this, where like there is a window between like on both sides of the equilibrium of like the Ogmoth deck's worst hands and the hammer deck's best hands. They don't overlap in the part where Ogmoth wins, and those are the shots you gotta take.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I guess on the subject of Ogmoth, one more matchup that was definitely asked about, and I have some pretty strong opinions on, is Ogmoth versus Burn. This is another case where it's sort of deterministic in that, like, the Ogmoth, it's the, like, the Lotus Field style of deterministic, where, like, your combo does not work. Your combo involves paying life. You do not have life in this matchup. What do you do? And I've actually, when I played this matchup as Ogmoth, I think I'm, like, 50-50 in this matchup. And the key is, like, trying to make some of your opponent's key cards a liability. So, like, the way I've won is just saying, I'm not going to combo, I'm just going to attack. All I'm going to do is save as much life as possible and attack. If my opponent plays an Eidolon, I am just attacking into it, and if they're playing burn spells, they're going to be taking damage, and that's what I want them to do. And you're trying to find ways to make their best cards not good by repositioning what you're doing. The Ogmoth versus Azorius is another similar matchup where, like, you are trying to play the matchup at a pace where, like, you may counterspell the liability by undercutting it early with, like, Stranglehold Geist and other beatdown, and then running, like, boarding into every copy of Endurance you can so you can play a threat on their end step. Someone had talked about, like, the Heliod versus Azorius matchup. You don't have the same level of flex to do that, but you should be trying to do that there, where, like, I think the problem card in that matchup is actually Prismatic Ending. So what you should really be doing is trying to set up spots where your Heliod is in your hand as Splinter Twin, and not a card that you ever deploy to the board, until your opponent has reached a spot where you have created the opening to resolve it.
Yeah, it's that example is almost a throwback. Like, I don't know what Heliod list we're even using as a baseline against the post MH2 control decks, but that might be an example where, like, the Heliod in your hand is almost the base spell, and the Collected Company, which then needs to hit the follow-up Heliod, is actually the thing that you care about resolving, because that's how you get it down in the relevant time window, for example. But yeah, with the Ogmoth against Burn case, I think one thing you can do is flip the script against them, where usually Burn is a deck that is a quantity deck. You need to add all your cards up, and hopefully they get across the finish line, which, if it's 20, that can be a problem. If it's less because people are taking all of this damage from their lands or their other cards, then that job is a lot easier. Ogmoth is a deck which, especially on the play, is very good at gummy up the ground. And so if Burn only gets one damage in with their Monastery Swiftspear before it just runs into this endless sea of undying creatures and Wall of Roots and stuff like that, they end up in this bind, right? Even if they're using the cards that are in their hand to remove those creatures to force their creature through, well, the end result is kind of the same. It's that you have nullified one or two cards, essentially, and preserved your life total in the process, and at that point, they just kind of run out of cards before they can do anything more to you. And so if you can then turn it around to where the Strangaroo Geist that was blanking their 2/2 now is like a relevant attacker, then you can close the game out before they can just draw enough Boros Charms and Lava Spikes and so on to win outside of combat. And then I think it's also, so you have some of that small tactical stuff, and then the classic thing of, like, just that one copy of Obstinate Baloth or whatever, Kitchen Finks, what have you, in my sideboard, that deck building choice does more to add more to the matchup than any kind of in-game tactical stuff really could.
It's a mix of finding the, like, you get to play your one big hate card, but also reposition your whole plan. It's really like, you know, and also you were talking about this trading cards thing that loops back to the first thing we were talking about. It's really a matchup that takes all these pieces and sort of ties them together to come to somewhere maybe close to 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I kind of wanted to theorycraft a matchup that I know is bad and try and think about ways to flip that script. And that matchup is it against Affinity? that is a very bad matchup for Izzet. When I was testing the Affinity deck, basically freely winning that matchup was the biggest reason to play it. And the problem is that, like, the Affinity deck has too many threats, and Raghavan is not a consistent attacker, and a lot of your threats are just, like, not good to kill with removal. And then also you have tutorable answers to Murktide in, like, either Spellbomb or Relic of Progenitus. So what can the Izzet deck do to kind of flip that around? The first thing I thought of is this is a spot where, like, Mystical Dispute is very good because it's very similar to, like, this is the case of, like, I'm trying to Prismatic ending their Chromatic Sphere. It's like, well, I just want a Mystical Dispute through Thoughtcast and hope that covers everything. Like, I am trying to open myself up to a good exchange. Unholy Heat, or I guess Lightning Bolt more accurately, is not going to good exchange for anything, but maybe this Dispute.
Yeah, I think that is somewhat sensitive to how the Affinity deck is built, because we've seen various builds that are built in lots of different ways, and if they are more on the, like, Esper Sentinel, Ingenious Smith side of things, then I think it's easy to get stranded with a Dispute, which you can't really cast, and even if you could, it wouldn't be that good. Versus if they are on the more blue-heavy side of things, then, yeah, I think Dispute might just be a natural necessity at that point.
Yeah, and then the other thing I wanted to highlight was this also feels like a matchup where even if they have a lot of answers to your Raghavan, you should just try to milk the equity of, like, the games where Raghavan hits them are very good still. So I should just play Raghavan and hope that it hits them.
Yeah, I think Raghavan, and we've seen this in both the decks that naturally want to play Raghavan, so Izzet Murktide, Grixis Shadow, and then also this is one of the selling points, as some would see it, of the four-color decks that play Raghavan, where sometimes your plan is just to connect with Raghavan and to leverage all your cards, so just doing that over and over again, and that can be a plan in your bad matchups, or even in the bad matchups for Raghavan, where sometimes, you know, there will be games against, like, Yawgmoth, for example, where you play a Raghavan, they play a Young Wolf, you Prismatic Ending their Young Wolf, and then you get to start connecting turn after turn, even if they're able to, in theory, present this continuous stream of roadblocks along the way.
Yeah, and then I think that about does it in terms of, you know, matchups we had laid out. We had a couple write-ins that we hadn't really filtered in here. Some of them I just kind of left for you to answer because they're amulet questions. So let's start with those. Because we had questions about how does Amulet fight Izzet and how does Amulet fight combo. Got any tips there?
The combo one, I think, is just not really interesting. You go fast, and if you have good interaction in the sideboard, you bring it in, and there's... I really honestly don't think there's much more to it than that. The Izzet question is a lot more interesting, because this is the recurring issue that Amulet has had to fight through ever since Modern Horizons 2, is... what do you do about the Izzet matchup? Which I think is bad, and the only debate really is just how bad is it? And I think one of the main issues is there is no way to cover your bases against everything. So they have pressure that's pretty good and can usually go through or over whatever you put in front of it, given enough time. They have Unholy Heat for your Titan, like the 6 damage lines are perfectly there. They have Counterspell for your draws, which are just shoving all in on one thing without protection. If you give them enough time, then they can, like, start leveraging their iterations and so on to, like, find these interactive cards that line up well against what you're doing. And then in the sideboard, they can have any number of different nightmares for you. So whether it's Blood Moon and or Makers of the Moon being the main one, but also, you know, Subtlety or Dress Down or Aethergust or all of these different cards which all interact with you in slightly different ways and all of which are highly annoying. And I think the upshot is there is no way to cover your bases against all of that at the same time. And so, you know, if you try out some cyborg plan that's been suggested to you, then there is a chance that it will just run into the wrong half of whatever your draw is or whatever their draw is, and the plan will look like it has failed, and you just have to accept that. Like, there is no guaranteed success rate here. In the past, I had a lot more success just loading up on Graveyard Hate against them. So Relic of Progenitus, Endurance, and stuff like that, and really leaning hard on those, because when their main threats are Dragon's Race Channeler and Murktide Regent, and their main interaction is Unholy Heat, then if you can prevent or weaken those cards, then a lot of the time their deck won't really do anything. And especially if the remaining threat in Ragavan is shut down by something like even just an Arboreal Grazer, but just anything that you can put in front of it, then their deck just kind of spins its tires and doesn't get anywhere. And then when you finally land your Dryad, land your Primeval Titan, it's actually pretty hard for them to do anything about it if Unholy Heat is offline. That whole equation kind of changed with Ledger Shredder, where now, especially in the decks that don't play DRC anymore and do have Shredder, well, now the graveyard is less important for them, and a card like Endurance, where some of the appeal in the past was both the effect is good, and sometimes it's like a shield for your Titan, right? You free cast it in response to Unholy Heat. And then also, if they do have Ragavan, well, this is a 3-4 body which can jump in front of it, and so now they have to spend some kind of relevant spell dealing with the Endurance to prevent that. Well, now eventually they're just going to have a big Ledger Shredder, or they can still present a big Murtide Regent. And so Endurance can buy you some time, but it's not going to be this single-handedly game-winning threat in quite the same way anymore. So I think the plan that I found that makes the most sense to me is just to just do your thing, drive hard, and hope that their draw doesn't line up against it in the way it needs to. Because there is this looming threat of cards like Blood Moon. If you give them enough time, they will find one of those cards. And unless you have one of your narrow band of answers, then it really doesn't matter what you've done in the game up to that point. The game will end. And you don't want to give them time to find like the subtleties and the dress sounds or whatever the other thing is. So the approach I found that works best is just keep all of your combo focused stuff, go up to 4 Cavern of Souls, board in like maybe 1-2 Endurance, but don't be overly reliant on effect like that, and just try to go fast and just bulldoze right through like exactly one piece of interaction if it doesn't line up the right way. And the move to Shredder, I think, actually does help that plan, because with DRC, they could develop this threat on turn 1 and then start applying pressure, and then every subsequent thing they did allow them to dig deeper for the relevant cards. Now with Shredder, there's still some amount of that if they do get to keep conniving turn after turn, but especially if you're on the play, there might just not be a good window for them to tap out for that turn 2 Ledger Shredder if it's their first threat, if you're threatening this fast kill on turn 3 or turn 4. So that, I think, has to be the plan. And so that is completely opposed to what some people are doing, which is to effectively de-emphasize all of the conditional combo stuff, so the amulets and the sagas and so on, and turn into this like wonky mid-rangey ramp deck with a bunch of endurances and tireless trackers and removal spells and so on. And to me, I wonder, like, what is that meant to be good against? Because as a deck, that doesn't sound very appealing or very powerful. And in the matchup, right, the reason that Valakut was this one-trick wonder that defeated 4-color but only in a tournament where they knew there would be no Murktide was because Murktide is very good traditionally at beating these like dedicated ramp decks that don't have this other angle. And Valakut is much better at being one of those decks than this hobbled version of Amulet Titan is. So I don't really get the virtue of that plan. And especially the card Tireless Tracker, which I think is just not really playable, honestly. But like when it dies to all of their removal and it doesn't block well, and sometimes it doesn't even attack well, and if they have one of their ultimate trumps, like if they have a Blood Moon effect or something, in theory, sometimes you can win with a Tireless Tracker, but it is a pipe dream, honestly. And so I think that just not trying to get cute and just going fast and doing your thing and exploiting their own weaknesses and inconsistencies is the way to go, instead of kind of giving into the fear and signing up for a game which you are behind in from the outset.
There you go. That is how you get to know bad matchups, correct?
Something like that. There is a weird contrast, though, with the Shadow matchups, both before and now, where in the past, if you go back to the Lurrus days, the Shadow matchup was a nightmare for Amulet, where like every single one of their cards lined up well against you, and it's like, well, I have to fight through all of their removal is good, all of their discard is good, Drown in the Lock is like doubly good. Both halves of this can be very effective. Dress Down, nightmare card for me that can also let them just kill me faster. Like every part of the buffalo was very good against you, and yet structurally I think there was more room to improve in that matchup if you were willing to warp your main deck or give up some sideboard slots to the point where by the end, I almost wanted to get paired against Shadow more than I did against Motai, just because it was easier to claw back some of that equity if you wanted to. And so you went to these very strange lengths where it's like, well, if I just load up on, Graveyard Hate and then good blockers, then they kind of have to be just a Shadow deck, but they're not a very good Shadow deck. And so they give me a lot of time, and then that gives me the time I need to like find a Titan or to like bob and weave around a dress down or something. And you know, there was this weird breakpoint where like, if you had a creature with 7 toughness, it was really difficult to kill. So you would board in a bunch of endurances, because those were good on the face of it. But also if you were playing a bunch of Turntable Symbiosis, then you had more threats that were also kind of resistant to discard. And then if you cast a Symbiosis, and even if you didn't hit a Titan, sometimes you almost wanted to hit like an endurance or a Dryad instead, because now you had this relevant body that had 7 toughness and got above this crucial breakpoint. So there were all of these weird hoops that you had to jump through. But in the end, I think there was more room to flip that around than there was against the Counterspell Blood Moon deck, where there was really only so much you could do there. And now, against this version of Shadow, which is it's slower, they don't have main deck dress down typically anymore. You don't have the Lurrus dress down loops or the threat of that looming over the game. I think the Shadow matchup now is better just at the starting line. And yet, if you want to improve that matchup, I think it's actually harder now because you don't have these very kind of obscure specific weaknesses that you can try and drive a wedge through.
That is interesting. That's really interesting. I've not considered how the small changes in the Shadow deck really changed that matchup. I'd actually kind of written it off on like, I never really got Lurrus and Samulet that much anyway, so, you know, whatever. I guess there was like the whole dress down lock that sort of eventually happened, but by that point you had already won the game.
Yeah, it was more like the threat of that loop being good just across the board let you justify putting more dress downs in your deck, and just having a dress down was so good against Amulet that was often good enough. And then if the game did go super long, well, now the Lurrus dress down thing could come into play, but it meant that they had this, they were kind of contesting you in the face of the game where you were meant to be good, and then still had you dominated in the phases where they knew they were good to begin with.
Gotcha. Okay, you have written in a matchup that is, technically, it cannot be a bad matchup, but it is a tough matchup. That's the Living End Mirror. And we had a bit of a chat about this in the Discord this week, where Living End experts, Canister and the CCR, were chiming in on this. And I think this one highlights like one last important thing, which is if the matchup is not necessarily bad, but just like a giant unsolvable mess, the thing I like to do is if there's anything that consistently makes me mad when my opponent does it, just try to make the matchup about exactly that.
And so in this case, that would be?
That would be Endurance Resolving or getting Street Race cycled on me after what I thought the terms of engagement of Livian's Resolving were. So the two things that kind of come up are, like, unless you have to hit a land drop or, like, the point of no return has been crossed and you're starting the Livian battles, Street Race should just chill in your hand and you can make the decision later on, like, where it belongs between your hand and your graveyard. And then with Endurances, you just, like, get them all in there. You want all of them. You want to fight over theirs with subtlety. If they're going to play Living or Leyline, then like you can fight that fight. But like you should really just be like leaning into the cards that get you out of the mess. I don't want to say cleanly, but like are a path out of the unsolvable part of the matchup.
Yeah, I think it's no secret that, okay, Endurance is going to be good against Living End, is going to be good in the Living End Mirror. But knowing the exact timing there, I guess, can be tricky. And then I do wonder if you just you took someone who you respected their general skills as a Magic player, but they maybe didn't play Modern that much or didn't play Living End at all, and just deposited them in this mirror and just had them battle it out for high stakes. I wonder how much just general Magic understanding would map onto this specific matchup.
Not a lot. It is an absolute mess, and it is one of the matchups that I have played Living in Mirrors since, like, the Monstrous Carabid days, and it has not gotten easier. It is a matchup where I am glad that the players who are Living on Specials were talking about it, because I almost don't feel qualified to talk about it after, what, like, most of a decade of banging my head into it.
Mm-hmm. So I guess trying to draw some general conclusions from this, I think there is a difference between this is a tough matchup just because we're kind of doing the same thing and they do it a little better than me, and so I'm going to try and re-up them or go to the next level there. So this would be the classic like Jund mirrors in Modern, or like Abzan control mirrors in Standard, stuff like that, where you're just trying to be the slightly bigger mid-range deck. I guess the mirror definitionally isn't that tough, but this can come up a lot with, I guess, Abzan aggro versus Abzan control in that standard format, right? Where, like, you weren't quite fast enough to go underneath them, but then they had this ability to just kind of go over the top of you with like, Elspeth and so on. And so there were a few different approaches to how to reflip that. And so for some people, you would try and actually leverage that early pressure more and try and get ahead on the board and, you know, find ways to always be on the front foot and to try and, like, get some chip damage in and then make their interaction line up awkwardly. And then for others, you would almost try and out-control the control deck. And, like, you would now, like, flip the script and be this, like, Den Protector, Wingmate Rock, Elspeth deck and just try and go bigger than them when they were trying to go slightly smaller now to not get overrun if that's what you're doing instead, if that makes sense. So just trying to find the right level to operate on. And in those cases, you're not really doing anything completely outside the box. You're not trying to make the matchup something fundamentally different. It's just about, you know, what wavelength are you on and trying to be on the right one, whether it's one above or one below. So in Modern, the example might be, if I'm playing my trusty all-foil Jund deck and I'm trying to find a way to beat four color, I'm probably not going for some radical transformative cyborg plan. I'm just, you know, maybe turning to my Torax or cards which let me win the grindy matchups, for that is what this is, and hoping that those will carry the day. Versus something like, you know, Footfalls versus Living End, where, like, just the way the cards line up, the text on the cards, what they're doing is so much better than me, and so I need to take some drastic steps to really flip that around if I'm going to have any hope here.
Yeah, I would lump those, like, four-color Jund matchups in that same kind of it's a mess as the Living End Mirror, but, like, less extreme. It's actually, maybe we could loop back to that Is It versus four-color matchup and lump it into the same kind of mess, except for I don't have a good answer from the Is It side what the things that are, like, these are the things that are bad that you should be doing to your opponent. It's just like, I don't know, hope one of the things lines up.
Yeah, I think that when you have decks like that, which are both quite fundamentally solid decks, part of that and part of what makes them so good is that there is no one obvious weakness. There's no, like, a hole in the Death Star, which, you know, with one simple trick, you can blow the entire thing up. You kind of have to just have a plan which is just, like, decent across the board and is kind of nimble and ready to exploit whatever comes up in the game versus just, you know, looking at the deck list here, this is the thing that I need to exploit.
Yep. That all checks out to me.
All right. Any other general takeaways before we get into some nonsense of the week to close it out?
Not really. Tough matchups are called that because they are actually tough, and it is going to take some thinking about it or copying other people's thinking about it to figure them out. So, I'm glad everyone asked about their favorite hard matchup to solve. I hope we covered most of them that we could. And if we didn't, feel free to chime in on the Discord and we can kind of walk through any thoughts that we have on it over the next week or so.
Absolutely. So let's get into our nonsense of the week. And we have each submitted one candidate here, so I'll let you kick this one off.
Yeah, the deck I submitted is, like, in the 50% nonsense category. There are 10 non-nonsense cards in the deck. So we've got Xenikos, God of Rebels, Worldspine Worm, Indomitable Creativity, and Thoughtseize. Okay, pretty normal. let's go down the list. Cards that have made the cut beyond that. Rotten Reunion. You know what that one does?
Oh, yeah. This is a banger. So this is a black exile target card from a graveyard, or up to one, and you get a 2/2 decayed zombie token. So it's not going to be a great attacker, but yeah, it's a game piece. You can do something with it. For example, target it with a creativity or a transmogrify, something in that vein. And then it also has flashback for one and a black, so you get two uses out of this. So in the context of Pioneer, which we should say this is where the deck is showing up, then you can eat that Archite Phoenix, get a 2/2, and then you know, flash it back, get something else, and then have two bodies ready to go for your creativity for two, which is what you need to get across the finish line here.
Okay. What about Vampire's Kiss?
Something involving blood tokens here. Could not tell you anything beyond that.
Okay. One in a black, drain two life, make two blood tokens.
Okay, I guess. Sure,
okay.
Sure.
Okay, so this is all tying together Deadly Dispute as your card draw engine. And then you also have Seize the Spoils, which it's kind of interesting that this isn't Big Score or like Unexpected. I guess Big Score is strictly better than Unexpected Windfall. I would have assumed you wanted the bigger Assured Way to hit two, but maybe you want the smaller one. Seize the Spoils is two in a red, discard a card to cast it, draw two, and make a treasure, as opposed to Big Score and Windfall, which are the four mana versions that make two treasures. So yeah, and also Sinkenzen as another way to make two tokens off a single permanent. So I really enjoyed this exploration of roundabout ways to cast Indomitable Creativity.
Yes, so the combo here is you get a Worldspine Moment of Play, so 15-15 Trample. When it dies, you get three 5/5s with Trample. And then also, when it is put into a graveyard from anywhere, you shuffle it into its owner's library. So you can Thoughtseize yourself if it comes to that. You can discard this two Seize the Spoils to get it back into your deck. So drawing it is not the catastrophe that, you know, in some of the earlier modern creativity decks, like drawing the Emrakul or drawing the Sarah's Emissary or something, could sometimes just really screw you over. And then you're pairing this with Xenagos, God of Revels. So this is one of the gods from the original Theros block. So at the beginning of combat on your turn, another target creature you control gains haste and +X/+X, where X is that creature's power. So the upshot is you are attacking with a 30-15 hasty Worldspine Moment, which against most boards is enough to win the game. And if they do have something that kills Worldspine Worm, unless it exiles, which is the real risk you have to avoid, if it is just your fateful absence or whatever, then you get a little bit back out of that as well. I think my favorite thing about this deck is the use of Deadly Dispute in a deck which, by definition, because of creativity, is locked out from playing both normal artifacts and normal creatures. But we have enough other token creators that we still get to use Deadly Dispute just to like cycle through cards and keep the cards flowing.
Yeah, my favorite part is the all one of sideboard that features two different cards that are like in the same category of not a creature or artifact, but they're doing that kind of work, which are Fungal Infection and Vampire's Vengeance. Fungal Infection, a Dominaria Limited All-Star. Black, neg one a creature until end of turn, Mega Sapperling. And then Vampire's Vengeance, two in a red, instant, deal two to each non-vampire and make a blood token. I just really like both of those cards showing up over there. Also, the silence in your deck that is just, I believe, only casting it off of the treasure tokens from Deadly Dispute and Spoils?
Yeah, there's not even any wonky off-color pathway hiding out in the mana base like that. That's all we got.
Yeah, I enjoyed this. This was a very delightful look through a alternate universe way to produce a functional, like a deck that is known functional. I just thought that was really cool.
Yeah, this player, Lyopile, is Julian Bellman, a world's competitor who has kind of made a name for himself over the past year, and someone who really enjoys just trying to make Indomitable Creativity work in any possible format. So from a sneak peek into his set championship testing, there are a lot of like Locust God, Sage of the Falls, creativity decks or whatever that understandably never got off the ground, but this is one more heave, one more attempt to make it work, so gotta salute that. The nonsense that I selected is Hammer Time, but not as we know it. So this is a Hammer deck that is also a Pure Sight Mero combo deck, I suppose.
Yeah, it's also an Aether Vial deck, so walk me through what is even going on here.
Okay, yeah, so I do not expect the words Pure Sight Mero combo deck to mean much to most people without an explanation. So Pure Sight Mero is a white-blue hybrid card, so two mana. It's a 2-2. It's from Eventide or Shadowmoor, Eventide, whichever one featured the delightful untap symbol mechanic. So the trick here is it has white-blue hybrid untap to look at the top card of your library and you may exile it. And if you pair this with Paradise Mantle, then it gains the ability to tap itself for a color of mana. So you essentially get to tap it and untap it over and over again to regulate the top of your deck and potentially exile all of it, at which point the one obligatory Thassa's Oracle lets you win the game. But even without that, this is a almost a like build your own... I don't even know what the right comparison is here, but you get to control the top of your deck. And so you already have some interest in Paradise Mantle, and going back to the early Hammer days, you had this debate over, do you want Paradise Mantle, do you want Springleaf Drum, or some mixture of the two? And so once you have Paradise Mantle, you can kind of splice in this secondary combo that gives you more ways to piece together a fast kill. The one other weird equipment here, which I had to look up, but I have faith that you won't, is a Shore Strike Trident.
Yeah, I vaguely knew what it did. I was not aware it cost two and not more than two.
Yeah, so this is two mana equipment that costs four to equip. And so this has... It gives the equipped creature first strike and tap, unattach this equipment. This creature deals damage equal to its power to target player. So I guess the idea here is if you have a Pure Steel Paladin and a hammer, maybe just the first attack will not get the job done. But what you can do is cycle both the hammer and the trident around every creature you have and let it unattach the trident to dome the opponent for 10. And so that hopefully will finish the job from there.
Well, you can also, with Pure Steel and Mero and Trident, for a mana per thing, you're paying a mana, potentially exiling the top card of your library, untapping the Mero, reattaching the trident for free with the Pure Steel, tapping the Mero, unattaching the trident, and you can sort of, like, build your own double fireball?
I suppose.
Yeah, that was the thing that first came to mind for me. I also really love the Paladin and Vex in the sideboard. I don't know why you would select this over Sanctifier on Vec or any other card, like Oriok Champion, but, like, you know, style points.
There are a lot of questions that one might have conceivably about the deck list.
Yeah, style points are what matters.
I mean, especially in your deck that is trying to get Aether Vial on two for any of Pure Sight Mero, Pure Steel Paladin, Simforged Mystic, you'd expect the two drop in Sanctifier Effect to really be the better choice there.
It's very possible. So this was a Haruya event in Japan. I would be willing to believe that this was a translation error in decklist entry too.
Okay, that is actually totally plausible. This was a top 8 in a 13-player tournament, so not necessarily a list to write home about, but this list was brought to my attention kind of by accident, and I thought it was so delightful that I couldn't help but share it there.
No, this is exactly what Nonsense of the Week is for. And I think this might be the second time Pure Sight Mero has shown up, because that is just, like, a very weird card.
Yeah, I don't know if there's some other combo shell. I'm sure that, like, we featured a Matsugan Pure Sight Mero deck in a previous Nonsense of the Week segment many months ago at this point.
Yeah, Shadowmoor, quite a set. I have been listening to some old episodes of the Resleevables, and Shadowmoor, it's got some cards. You could actually, like, if you listen to the Shadowmoor and Eventide ones, you could hear the point where P. Sully questions whether he wants to ever look at another Magic card again in his voice, and then somehow Cedric got him to continue on for another 6 episodes, which is really astounding.
Yeah, for all those people out there who are constantly asking, when will the receivables return? That you can kind of trace the point where at least one brain was broken in the process of recording that.
Yeah, it was not sure whether it was like Saviors or Prophecy or Eventide that did it, but there's a lot of bad sets, and making someone like sit there and read them all over and over again is probably not the best thing for mental health, you know?
Yeah, we'll give them some time to decompress and then check back in. in a few months. In any case, that will do it for this week. So we will be back next week with a new topic and a healthy heaping of new nonsense. In the meantime, you can find us on Twitter. I'm at Domin Javier. He is at ARMLX. You can find our respective columns on SCG and TCG Player. You can find the podcast on Twitter at @Dominaria_pod. You can find us and support us on Patreon at patreon.com/Dominaria_judgment. And you can join the Discord. Always happy to see new faces in there and discuss both nonsense and serious topics, whatever takes your fancy. So hope to see all of you there in the meantime, and we'll be back next week. Take care, everyone.